I decided to call this talk Some Reflections on Patience. But it's actually also a bit of a reflection on the Metta-Bhavana practice also, and the Brahma-Viharas in particular, as kind of ways of gaining insight. So as I go through the talk, we'll probably get to grips with it. Right. It's predominantly, of course, about patience. When we look at the spiritual life, when we look at, say, here we are, we've got the formulations of the spiritual life. We've got, say, the six paramitas, and we've also got eightfold paths. We could have any amount of formulations. But one of the simplest is verse 183 of the Dhammapada. And it says, cease to do evil, learn to do good, purify the mind. That's all. Cease to do evil, learn to do good. That's a succinct one. Sometimes it's a wee bit more elaborate than that. You know, but putting it in a nutshell, putting it up on your wall, cease to do evil, learn to do good, purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. What that really means, when you give it a little bit of a thought here, is that a big chunk of spiritual life is actually about ceasing to do evil. You know, maybe it's obvious. Stopping doing unskillful things, practicing skillful things, and ultimately gaining insight, the purification of your mind. And it's the same with the paramitas. The ultimate paramita is, of course, pranya. That's what we're aiming for, the purification of the mind. And why do we do that? Well, it's simple, and the answer comes from the first couple of verses of Dhammapada. If one speaks or acts with an unskillful state of mind or impure mind, unhappiness follows, just as carefully follows the hoof thumps. If we speak or act with a pure mind, happiness follows. So therefore, we try and cease to do evil and learn to do good. Simple, isn't it? At least in theory, as it's been said before. But I'd like to kind of reflect upon that a little bit, that kind of statement, and actually reflect upon the importance of restraint in the spiritual life. And maybe this is something we don't like to hear. It's about spiritual life, it's about controlling yourself, about restraining yourself, about abstaining from things. And we live in a quite nihilistic age, and people don't like that type of language. You know, some people might say, well, why not just cultivate the positive, and it'll take care of itself. But actually, my reflections on it are that that's not true. You know, sometimes you do have to bite the bullet, recognize the fact that you're doing unskillful things, stop doing them. Yeah. I think you have to look at, say, the planet itself. You know, you do a lot of unskillful things, we just stop doing them. Yeah. Or it could lead to disaster or war or whatever. We just stop doing them. So I've got a few little reflections here taken from the Dhammapada just to reflect upon that particular way of looking at things, right? The importance of this kind of restraint. The first little reflection, I've only got 5 little reflections. This is from the section of the elephant, verse 320. As an elephant in battle withstands arrows shot from bows all around, even so I will endure abuse. A tamed elephant can be led into a crowd, and the king mounts a trained elephant. So too, best among humans is the subdued one who endures abuse. People don't like to hear that. Yeah. But there it is. He is talking about an elephant. You know, we stop the fight when he's talking about an elephant. He doesn't say pet rabbit, your hamster. He's talking about an animal that's really thick-skinned going into battle. You know, and you get this kind of feeling, here's that elephant, tough to endure them. Of course, the spiritual life isn't just about enduring abuse, there's other things as well. But putting up with it, biting the bullet, in that type of way, strengthens our character. And we have to be strong to be able to do it. Second reflection, the mind, verse 42. whatever harm an enemy may do to an enemy, or a hater to a hater, an ill-directed mind inflicts on oneself greater harm. So here you have two enemies battling out, two people who really hate one another, battling it out, but you, an ill-directed mind, a mind that's not given a positive direction, will do yourself greater harm. It's another way of saying you're your own worst enemy. And if you don't control those negative influences in your life, you do yourself more harm than any enemy could do to you. You're our own. Of course, we can be our own best friend. That's the good news. Next one, from the Bhikkhu section, verse 361. Good is restraint in the body. Good is restraint in speech. Good is restraint in thought. Restraint everywhere is good. The monk restrained in every way is freed from all suffering. That's an amazing statement. I think one of them actually says, restraint is excellent. There's one translation. Restraint is excellent. If you've got a real desire to express a negative state, do somebody a bit of harm through it, and you restrain yourself, that is excellent. Restraint everywhere is good. Because he's talking about restraint, negativity. We'll go into that in a minute. Right. From the Buddha section, verse 184. Enduring patience is the highest austerity. Nibbana is supreme, say the Buddhas. He is not a true monk who harms another, nor a real renunciant who oppresses others. Patience is the greatest austerity. You know, comes up time and time again, Shantideva, patience is the greatest austerity. It's tough, it's not easy, and you can learn a lot from practicing patience. Okay. We don't restrain the positive. That's obvious, isn't it? We're talking here about restraining the expression of harmful negative states of mind. The Buddha doesn't say restrain your metta. Hold back on your equanimity. Never mind rejoicing in other people's merits. Don't overdo it. You know? Compassion. Well, don't want you overdoing that either. Sometimes I think that the Brahmaviharas are called the immeasurables. I think it's even the limitless abodes. You don't hold back on that. I don't know if everybody here has seen one or two kind of relatively new faces aware of what the Brahmaviharas are. I mean, you've got metta, which is universal loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, sympathetic joy, and upekkha, equanimity. And they're considered quite lofty states of mind. Sadly, in our society, which is probably quite low on emotional positivity, people think, that'd be kidding us on here, wouldn't it? I mean, probably there's a lot of people here, I would guess, who've kind of supported meditation courses, like led, you know. And you get this time and time again. Don't you think if you have too much metta, people will take advantage of you? They'll take a loan of you. Or maybe if you've got too much contentment or equanimity, wouldn't life be a bit dull? You know, I mean, equanimity, well, you won't be sending rockets to the moon, will you? You know, this type of thing, it's a bit dull. And it sounds a bit dull, but it's just quite indicative of the society that we live in. The positive emotion, not appreciated to that extent. These are lofty states of mind. Yeah. And metta, okay, people can take advantage of you. Let them. You know, what's wrong with somebody taking advantage of you? If it's skillful to do so, you can just say a choice, I'll let this person take advantage of you. Simple as that. Or, equanimity, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with being equanimous and being attentive within yourself? But I think if people take advantage of us, it's probably not because of metta. It's probably because of one of the near enemies of the Brahmaviharas, either sentimentality or pity. And we've allowed somebody to take advantage of us because of that type of thing. I think Sangharashita has a definition for sentimentality. The person who's sentimental feels more than is justified. And the person who's cynical feels less than is justified. Which brings in a quite interesting observation about meta. I don't know if anybody's read Sanger Shido's Living with Kindness, a great book, really worth reading. He points out something quite strange that you may not think about. What he points out is that meta is a rational emotion. What do we mean by that? It's a rational emotion. In any situation that you find yourself in, there should be a response to the objective needs of that particular situation. Right. And he says that meta is always the right response in any situation you're in. Maybe we don't think that. Maybe we think, I'll give that person as good as I've got, or whatever. And we don't respond. But meta is an objective, rational response to any other human being. And if you stop and think about it, it must be true, really. You know, if you're in a positive state of mind, you see things more clearly. If you're in a negative state of mind, anxious or hateful, you don't see things clearly. You see things essentially as a threat to you. With metta, you don't see that. You see the needs. Now, that doesn't mean to say that in any situation, you'll always get it right. But you're more likely to get it right if you respond with metta. Okay, so metta is a rational emotion. And of course, the other Brahma-viharas also are important here. The sense of equanimity and compassion also. Okay, I'm going to start talking about patience now. Well, when we actually look at any particular quality here, but looking at, say, I said, cease to do evil and learn to do good, purifying the mind. Right, okay, we got that. And we can look at the paramitas in exactly the same way. For example, if we look at dana paramita, what are we saying? At one end of the spectrum, we're saying we abstain from taking the not given. And at that end of the spectrum, we've warmed up a bit. We give. And we give the greatest gift of all, the gift of the Dharma. And we could actually say that the gift of the Dharma, being the greatest gift of all, we can only give it fully if our minds are pure. Pranya, in other words. So that's a little example of a perfection. Indeed, you can, when we actually stop to reflect upon it, the precepts about abstaining also. Pheromone, sikkhapadam, samadhi, ami. Pheromone means to abstain from, to refrain from. Undertake the rule of training to abstain from. So how do we apply that to patience? What's at one end of the scale and what is at the other end of the scale? Right? Now, this, if you read the different translations of the Bodhicharyavatara, which is Shantideva's famous text in the 7th century, Entering the Path of Enlightenment, because some people don't know. In the Crosby-Skilton translation, they point out something quite interesting, right? That the word that has come down mostly for patience and forbearance is kshanti, in a soft K, kshanti, right? But actually, the word for patience is actually kshama. Kshama. The more literal translation of patience is kshama. Kshanti more or less means forbearance. But the two became intermingled, and what seems to have happened was maybe it was adopted as a perfection to have one word. We'll just stick with kshanti. But you've got those two things, and they're quite different from one another. You know, kshanti means more or less forbearance, right? And kshama means patience in the full sense. What's the difference between the two? What is the difference? We're going to look at the English translation here. Forbear. To cease or refrain from doing something. To tolerate. Forbearance, the act of forbearing. So it means to cease or refrain from doing something. We're angry, we're hateful, we want to punch somebody. But we don't. Good Buddhists, we are. Patience, enduring trying circumstances, tolerance, understanding, accepting delay with equanimity. Now that's a kind of English translation. Now, let's try and put a kind of Buddhist flavour on that a little bit here. Let's say, okay, the forbearance one's okay, we'll go for that. Refraining from expressing hate, essentially, or anger. Patience, in the kind of Buddhist sense, they've got a wee bit right here. You've got equanimity, you've got understanding. You know, I'm looking at other people, being aware of them, being receptive to them, if you like. And within that, we can actually argue, you cannot have patience without the Brahma Viharas. In its more fully developed sense, it would actually be impossible to be really patient without having goodwill, metta, equanimity with the Brahma Viharas. Right. So we can say that within patience, when we're cultivating patience, actually indirectly, we're cultivating the Brahma Viharas as well. I hope this will become a wee bit clearer. So it's in there. Positive emotions in there. Right. Here's a little kind of interesting aside. Right. Did the Buddha practice forbearance? Did the Buddha practice forbearance? Did he even practice patience? Interesting little reflection. No, he didn't. Didn't need to. If someone is restraining a negative state of mind, and the Buddha doesn't have a negative state of mind, he couldn't be forbearing, could he? Yeah. Because we could say that the Buddha is patient, but we might not even say that. Who are we to say what a Buddha's like? I don't want to get over philosophical here, but maybe the Buddha didn't even see himself as being patient either. You know, does the sun sort of see itself as being generous because it just radiates its light and warmth? It's just the way it is, you know? And this quite famous little sutta, the Akosha Sutta, I think kind of stresses this point. Maybe you've heard this sutta many times, but I want to say a few things about it, because sometimes it's often spoken about in a slightly limited type of way. And the story, the Akosha Sutta, is by a Brahmin called Akosha. And his name apparently means the abuser. He went about abusing people. That was his part of his deal as a Brahmin. He went to be that way, saying nasty things to people. And the story goes, the Akosha comes to the Buddha, insults him, and the Buddha sits quietly and says, you know, okay, I'll just listen to you. Just question, doesn't respond, and he just says to Akosha, that you finished things what you have to say? And Akosha goes, yeah, I finished. And the Buddha says, often the way this is described is in terms of a present. Suppose you gave me a present, and I don't take that present. What happens to it? Well, it stays with you. So he says to Akosha, well, that those insults stay with you. It's your karma, basically. Yeah. But actually, in the sutta, the actual present is a meal. Right. And the Buddha says, suppose somebody offered somebody to share a meal with someone. They didn't share the meal. They'd have to eat it all themselves. You know. So this analogy of sharing a meal is very much like, I'm not going to get into this dispute with you. I'm not doing it. I'm not going to get into worldly warfare with you, get uptight, get angry, and we'll all get heated. I'm not sharing this meal with you. You know? And it's always, you know, to eat it yourself. You know? And he does that out of compassion. He says, by not doing that, we stop, we look at it, and we reflect with equanimity. And that does both parties benefit. You know, obviously, the Buddha's talking, generally speaking, you know, he doesn't get angry. But other people may do. And if you don't get caught up and share the meal, you don't get into this kind of predicament. There's another little interesting thing with Akosha says to the Buddha. The king, together with his court, know this of Master Gautama. Gautama, the contemplative, is an arahant, so enlightened. And yet, still Master Gautama gets angry. The Buddha goes, denies this, he says. Whence is there anger? From one free from anger, tamed, living in tune, one released through right knowing, calmed and such. So he denies that he has anger. No, he denies that he has hate. That's as simple as that. He's saying, I don't have anger. I don't have hate. This is wrong, you know. So he's not biting the bullet here. He's an Angora. He just sits quiet and listens to the Brahman. Another little interesting reflection here is how it ends. And he says, when you work the cure of both, you don't get caught up in this debate, your own, the others, those who think you are fool know nothing of Dharma. What that really means is that some people would look at that situation and say, you don't do that. Someone's been insulting to you. Get stuck in there. Give as good as you've taken, in other words. And they consider the Buddha and that type of person to be a fool to do that. That's what he's saying. He said, the Buddhas, you consider somebody to be a fool who would not, you know, give as good as they can get. He says, those people do not understand the Dharma. You know? And I think Sangha Rishido once said, if you had to put the Dharma into one word, it would be ahimsa, not violence. So they're not understanding the Dharma. Right. The remaining reflections upon patience here is going to come from the Bodhicharya Avatara. A number of verses from it. A number of different topics, if you like, are brought out of interest. Six sections. Patience as an antidote to hate. Patience as an austerity. Patience arising from reflections on conditionality. Patience and tolerance. Patience and insight. And last but not least, the serious one, patience here and now. Right, okay. Maybe some people have heard this kind of stuff before. Patience as an antidote to hate. The Matrix translation, verses 1 and 2. I like this, some of the stuff in here, and I like the Skilton translation as well. But verses 1 and 2. Matrix begins with one word. That one word is hostility. Right? Hostility. The desire to harm somebody else. And he says this. Hostility destroys all the moral conduct, charity and reverence of the Buddhas, which has been achieved in thousands of aeons. No evil is equal to hatred, and no austerity is equal to patience. Therefore, one ought diligently to cultivate patience by a variety of means. In other words, it's considered Mahayana Buddhism that hostility, hatred, is the worst possible vice. But it said that if you have craving, that's okay, it's not too bad. Because you still want to embrace human beings. But with hostility and hatred, in other words, basically hatred, you want to harm them. You push them away. So hatred in the Mahayana Buddhism is the worst possible vice, you know? But I was stopping to reflect, why? Why should patience be the antidote to hatred? Should not be the Metta-bhavana or the 10 precepts changing hatred into compassion. Should not be compassion. Why? Well, of course, it should be. You know, but why bother having the patience? But why not just have the Metta? And shortly, I suppose it's a bit like saying, why do we have 5 or 10 precepts? You know, why not just have one precept? You know, maybe even if you had one precept, you'd have to eventually come to the conclusion that your ethics works in different ways. So therefore, you bring in all the other precepts to identify what you need to do. And I think patience of all those things really identifies where we are hateful. We get a quite deep insight from being patient, from practicing the austerity of patience, we feel it quite strongly. I hate that person, I really dislike to assault them. And patience, that forbearance, just puts you back on yourself in a quite strong way. I need to resist this, I need to forbear, I need to work on this quite hard, you know. So the cultivation of patience, a very direct insight into our condition of hatred, you know. Because this second part follows on from the first part, where it says, no evil is equal to hatred, and no austerity is equal to patience. Patience now as an austerity. Verses 13. In Kanata, the devotees of Durga willingly endure to no purpose the pain of burns, cuts, and worse. Why then am I a coward when my goal is liberation? There's nothing which remains difficult if it is practiced. So through practice with minor difficulties, even major discomfort becomes bearable. He's basically saying, here's all those people practicing austerities as they did during the Buddha's day. We know that the Buddha practiced austerities, self-torture, etc., in his quest for liberation, his quest for enlightenment, and did not succeed. Right? And this is still going on. Not getting anywhere, you know. I mean, this comes out in the Dhammapada, where the Buddha says, patience is the greatest austerity. You know, what he's getting at is, okay, have a bit of pain and discomfort, but you'll be liberated by it. Here's the sons of Durga, the Kanatas, I believe they're kind of followers of Kali, who kind of torture themselves, you know. There's other followers of Kali, I think, called the Thugai, and that their job was to assassinate people, you know. Maybe that was their kind of thinking liberation by killing other people. I don't know if that was a general idea. That's where the word thug came from. You know, maybe they were a bit more out of regard than maybe like, you know, but the Durgas just done themselves in, you know. So he's saying, well, here you are. There's all these people doing themselves harm. And they're getting nowhere. Whereas you, all you have to do is practice patience. It's not going to kill you. You know? And yet, you're a coward. You're not facing up to it. You're not facing up to those different situations. It's people saying, don't be a wimp. Come on. Toughen yourself up here. You know, start off with a little pain and work up, you know, to more difficult situations. So this is a Shantideva in his book, if you read it. And if you're not in the right mood to read it, you will find it incredibly irritating. You know, you'll just think, this guy's not letting you away with it. A lot of it's over the top. But the whole point of the whole thing is to look at it and even provoke you to some extent into saying, right, okay, you know. Of course, in practical terms, there's a limit to what anybody can endure, you know. So it's not about, you know, self-mortification and practicing patience, you know. So here we go. Practice patience and you'll be liberated, ultimately. The next one I've got, this is a kind of complicated one. Patience arising from reflections on conditionality. There's a couple of wee interesting bits here that are worth kind of reflecting upon. Verses 24 and 20. There we go. This is quite complicated. No, this one here. It says something interesting here. Right. Person does not get angry at will, having decided, I shall get angry. Nor does anger well up after deciding, I shall well up, you know. Whatever transgressions and evil deeds of various kinds there are, all arise through the power of conditioning factors, while there's nothing that arises independently. In other words, there's a wee bit of a debate here. He's saying anger and hate arise, but we don't actually intend them to arise. We don't actually say, today I'm going to go and hate somebody. They just come up. We well up. We get angry. We get disturbed. And we want to just inflict a bit of damage on somebody else. You know? because naturally, being decent people, we control it. But it doesn't just happen. It happens quite without us even wanting to happen. And that begs a question here about free will. You know, if those things are out of our control, do you have any free will? You know, they don't arise because we intend to arise, but we see them. Of course, they arise because of conditioning factors. What are those conditioning factors? Oh, that's a million and one conditioning factors, so we'll have to look at them all. But primarily, of course, you've got parental upbringing, society, religious views, whatever they are. We've got those conditions. Some of them are quite unhealthy. Right? We've also got evolution. We've inherited. I mean, they didn't know about evolution in those days. Well, they maybe had a kind of rudimentary idea about evolution, to give them some credit here, seems to be. But they didn't know about evolution. And we talk in terms of moving away from the lower evolution to the higher evolution. Lower evolution is biological, collective. The higher evolution is individual. And if you look quite closely, we've inherited quite a lot of quite strong instinctive desires that can be quite destructive. They're unconscious. They may be even reptilian, if you like. And it just come to the surface as a kind of defense mechanism, you know, in some sort of way. We apply them to the tribe, to the society we live in, and we find ourselves governed by those particular emotional states. Because Buddhists would just say we're governed by craving, aversion, and delusion. Indeed, we are, without necessarily analyzing the way of evolutionary process, but we've inherited them in that particular way, and we have to work with them. And a lot of them are not conscious. Naturally, when they come up and we see it, I guess it's an advantage that we'll do something about it. But we could reverse the argument here, which Shantideva doesn't do. You say if these negative states of mind come up just by accident, we could actually say, well, let's have positive states of mind consciously, you know. Let's get the feedback going the other way. You know, if negative has come out that way, we have to do something about it. Okay, conditioning factors say we can reverse the polarities of the night. You know, with metta, with the Brahma-viharas, we can start planting seeds, if you like, in the other direction. And those seeds will germinate, and they'll turn into lotuses. You know, so it's both ways. There's all these different arguments you get in neurology about do we have free will and all the rest of it. And sometimes we oh, haven't, and then somebody else, oh yes, we do have. And there's debates about the different types of experiments that are done and seem to go on endlessly, you know. But if it can go one way, surely it can go the way, you know. So that would be the Buddhist argument. Buddhist argument would be that the more evolved you are, the more free will you have. That would be it. That would be the argument. But we don't have a great deal of free will. We're working on it. The more we understand ourselves in depth, the more enlightened we are, the more insight we have, then the more free will we have. And it can escalate until eventually liberation arises. The other reflection upon conditionality is this. Here's an argument, really, and Shantideva is gets a wee bit technical in the book here, but basically is arguing against the Atman doctrine, right? Against particular Atman doctrine, the idea that they've got an unchanging soul or a God in the sky, right? So the main part is quite lengthy, this wee argument, but this is a kind of disposes of the argument of the Atman, right? And of course, his process of doing that is to cause us to reflect on Praticca Samuppada. That is conditioned co-arising, right? And conditioned co-arising can actually cause us to be more patient. How is that? Well, he says here, right, this is the end bit of the argument. In this way, everything is dependent upon something else, all interrelated. Even that thing upon which each is dependent is not independent. In other words, the whole of interconnectedness, we get it. Since like a magical display, phenomena did not initiate activity, at what does one get angry like this? And then he goes on to say, therefore, even if one sees a friend or an enemy behaving badly, one can reflect that there are specific conditioning factors that determine this and thereby remain happy. You know, what that really means is a lot of time we don't know what's made people the way they are. You know, we don't know, there they are, they appear in front of us by magic, and we don't know. And maybe we can get impatient with them, you know, or whatever, and maybe just take a dislike to it. But if we stop to reflect, I don't know what made that person the way it is. And sometimes when we find out what made them the way they are, it can cause us to be a bit more compassionate and a bit more patient with them. That person didn't have a very good upbringing, or they were abused, or whatever, and that's the way they are. And you think, well, okay, that's the way they are. And through that reflection upon conditionality, we become patient. You know? I think sometimes, you know, it's like sometimes people can see conditionality a bit cold, you know, but sometimes if you think, well, oh, isn't it nice to have a God and all the rest of it that looks after you? But this God seems to do really horrible things to humanity, you know, and you wonder, well, why bother, you know? But sometimes when you reflect upon conditionality, there's factors that make people the way they are. And if we reflect upon that, we don't know what they are. We can have a bit more compassion towards them. Indeed, we could reverse the argument by pointing at ourselves. We may think that we know what's made us what we are, but sometimes we don't. Sometimes we're unconscious of our own conditioning. So in this particular respect, we can actually reverse the argument and say, well, actually, I can reflect upon sometimes I don't know what's made me the way I am, you know, and have some patience towards yourself as well. If you see it, that hopefully the argument works to some extent. Because we don't know. You know, sometimes we're fierce. We don't know why we're afraid. You know, we're anxious or whatever. We start to become more conscious of them. And we start to recognize, yeah, okay, I'm getting to grips with this. But being patient with yourself, reflecting that you're the product of all this conditioning as well. You know? Patience and tolerance. Patience and tolerance. I was reading a book at the beginning of the year. Maybe some people have read this book. I was wanting to read it for a while. And it was by William James, right? Who was a Christian, you know, very sincere Christian. And he's given quite a lot of lectures in the year 1910 in Edinburgh. And they're all transcribed. And they're all really worth reading. It's called The Varieties of Religious Experience, right? And he's talking to an educated audience of presumably good Christians, right? And he talks about the history of Christianity, some bits and pieces of quite eccentric characters practicing mysticism and whatever. But he bemoans something. He says, when you take all the main names of Christianity, who are they? You know, we bring out a few. Martin Luther, Francis Xavier, Ignatius of Loyola, founders of particular schools, even Oliver Cromwell, dare I say. They're all considered religious reformers. He says every single one of them, what they had in common was they thought nothing of persecuting anybody who didn't agree with them. Every single one of them, they condoned violence and killing. And that's sad, and he thinks it's sad. And it seems to be the result of a theistic tradition. You know, it's a result of worshipping a jealous God, you know, that punishes people. There's fear there, and out of that fear, people punish people who don't agree with them. It's a sad reflection. Islam, not very good either, I'm sorry to say. In 1197, the famous Nalanda University was burnt and totally destroyed by the Islamic invasions of 1197. This is a famous university that produced the Bodhicharya Avatara. A lot of those scriptures are lost totally to us. They could have been a great benefit to humanity. Somebody looked at it, they didn't like it, and they went and burnt that university to the ground and killed literally tens of thousands of monks and other scholars. And that's shocking. And it's a result of worshipping an all-powerful God. Right? Even, I just read recently that in this country, it was only in 2008 that they finally abandoned the blasphemy laws. Would you believe that? 2008. You know, and some people thought, well, we'd never use them anyway. But they did use them. They used them in the famous gay news trial in the mid-1970s. And some people still wanted to uphold them. You know, we've managed to get rid of them now. You know? And this filters through our society in very subtle ways. You know, I remember the 1970s, or even the 1980s, the Life of Brian was banned in this city because it was blasphemous. It was banned. I don't know if people know that. And so was Ken Russell's film, The Devils. It was inappropriate for us to watch it. You had to go to Edinburgh to see it. And I think, what? Sorry, but I can't get this, you know. And I think William James, when he was talking, he was talking to a lot of good people. He considered himself to be good Christians, but had to live with that. They had to live with that sometimes dreadful history. You know, they didn't have to have crusades. They didn't have to have inquisitions. They could have said, no, we're not going to have them. They could have brought peace to this country, and they didn't do it. You know, and that's bad. That's shocking, I think. What's the Buddhist point of view? It's an interesting little verse here. I'm trying to find it. Where Shantideva says this, and my hatred towards those who damage sacred images and stupas, or who abuse the true teachings, is inappropriate, since the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are not distressed. When people harm one's teachers, relatives, and others dear to us, one should, as above, regard it as arising on the basis of conditioning factors and remain free from anger towards them. You know, he's saying the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, in their wisdom and compassion, are not distressed. They are not angry. They are not seeking revenge. Therefore, I will not do that either. You know, that's all he says. I won't do that either. You know, and he goes on further to reflect, well, these are conditioning factors that's made people that way. That general level of intolerance or whatever that they're brought up to be. And he says, well, okay, don't get angry with them. You know? So that's a quite interesting. What would the Bodhisattvas do? In other words, and he's saying, no, you wouldn't respond with revenge or violence in that type of situation. Quite a difference. Patience and insight. Right? Okay, patience and insight. What do we mean by insight? I think when we look at insight, we can see insight in two ways. We can see it with a small I or with a big I. In other words, transcendental insight. Maybe I've gone into this to some extent earlier on. Patience with a small I. Again, when we are patient, you know, we gain a quite deep insight into our negativity. We gain a deep insight into a hatred, in other words. This is the antidote to hate, you must like. When we forbear and we put up with something, it's a big learning situation for us. It's a painful one, but we can actually get a quite deep insight into how our general ego tendencies actually work. You know, the defense mechanisms that go on, we can stop and think, this is me. I really hate that person. Or I really get angry with them. Why? And if we reflect upon it and try and forbear, we'll actually get quite deep insights into the nature of our self and the self that we are trying to defend. Right? We'll also come to another conclusion, that the way out of this can only be compassion and metta. Right? It means that when we're being patient and we forbear, to deal with it effectively, we have to cultivate the Brahma-vihāras. That's what it really means. Sangharakṣita, in his book, Living with Kindness, says something really quite interesting. The book is about using metta and the Brahma-viharas as a means to insight. He says that very often this is not appreciated in the Buddhist tradition. There's not enough value put on metta. There's not enough value put on the Brahma-viharas. But he's actually saying that these are the main ways by which we can gain a deeper insight. Why is that? Obviously, we're overcoming hatred. Obviously, we are, if you like, expanding the self out of the way, without any fear, to a greater and higher reality. You know? So when we cultivate patience, we're moving into cultivating compassion as well, and wisdom, and a deeper insight in the transcendental sense of the term. There's a little passage towards the end of the book, Living with Kindness, where he talks about metta and insight, and he says this: at the back of every negative emotion, there's always the thought, "What's in this for me?" The back of every negative emotion, there's always a thought, "What's in this for me? What did I get out of it?" You know, and maybe at the back of a positive emotion, that thought is not really there. You know, in our everyday life, we can see it. We can see it in small ways, in big ways. Oh, I want to do somebody a favor. I can't be bothered. What's in it for me? You know, I'm waiting in a queue, getting frustrated. This is disrupting us. I don't like this. What's in this for me? You know, in a way, it's a form of craving. I want something. I'm not getting it. Therefore, what's the point? And he says that the way to get rid of that quite self-centered tendency is to cultivate metta. He says something quite interesting, that ultimately metta has no object. We think, oh, you've got an object, a person you like, a person you dislike, a neutral person, and okay, that gets us up and running. But ultimately, it has no object. You just radiate metta, you know. Whether somebody's there or not, you simply have metta because it is your natural state to be in. As it says in the Metta Sutta, being seen or unseen. You know, you just have metta, just about like the sun shining, whether there's any planets there or not. And that's the ultimate goal of our metta bhavana practice. And Sangha Rakshita says, if we cultivate metta, we must remember that wisdom is essentially emotional. Alright, there's a cognitive element to it. It's essentially emotional. It's about your emotional relationship with the cosmos or the world that you live in. Right? He goes into that in Wisdom Beyond Words. So, by cultivating patience, we move into the Brahma Viharas and also the possibility of greater insights through cultivation of the Brahma Viharas. And there's two kind of paths in Buddhism. One is often called liberation through wisdom, that is liberation of the heart. And to say that there is those two is to say that actually you can get liberated. Technically speaking, liberation of the heart is not liberation as such, but it takes you so close to it, so close to enlightenment, that the jump you have to make is very small. So the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas is a necessary part of gaining insight. The last one. Patience here and now. Okay, what do I mean by that? I find that the last four sections of the... I'm just going to end up in this bit here. Are quite interesting. He'll say, typical Mahayana Buddhism, where Shantideva says, right, what's going to happen to you if you don't cultivate patience? He said, well, you're going to go to a hell realm, aren't you? I mean, there's the future hell, there's plenty of kind of nasty flames there waiting for you, you know? What's the harm that you could do, which a wrathful king could do to you? You know, it's worse than that, you know? So he's saying, cultivate patience and you won't go to those hell realms, you know? You'll overcome hate. He says, what are the rewards? He said, the rewards are even greater than a gratified king could give you. Because you're attaining enlightenment. So you've got this gratified king, gives you all these treasures. Cultivating patience is even better than that. Right. Of course, this is all metaphorical stuff, really. But when you stop to think about it, a hell realm. Right, a hell realm. Someone once said, hell is a state of extreme subjectivity. And a person is, if they're in a hateful, angry state, there's people in that state a lot of time. It's hell for them. You don't want to be in that state, you know. And by cultivating patience, of course, we get ourselves out of that state. So it liberates us. All right, the language is a bit over the top. But then he goes on to say, well, supposing there was no Buddhahood. Right, supposing the Buddhahood didn't exist. Right. If you practice patience in this life, and you free yourself from pain, well, you'll be happier for it. It's a bit like the Kalama Sutta. Kalama's doubting whether they're going to be reborn or not. And the Buddha just says, well, if you overcome craving, aversion, and delusion, you have a favorable rebirth. You know, if you overcome craving, aversion, and delusion, and you're not reborn, you'll be happy in this life, you know. So he's stressing something. You'll be happy in cyclical existence if you cultivate patience. Right? So I'm just going to end up by reading those four verses as a little reflection and contemplation, and we'll just finish there. What could a wrathful king do that would equal the agony of hell, experienced as a result of causing misery to living beings? What could a gratified king give that would equal Buddhahood, experienced as a result of causing happiness to living beings? Never mind future Buddhahood arising from the propitiation of living beings. Do you not see good fortune, renown, and well-being right here and now? Serenity, freedom from disease, joy and long life, the happiness of an emperor, prosperity. These the patient person receives while continuing in cyclic existence. Thank you.